Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 1352.1TH0207, certificate number 16065. Twee.
So come to me and I will keep you warm. Taste hope in my skin and face with the dawn.
Texted you yesterday saying, yes, we are going to record Omnibus because we believe in this endeavor.
We do. It's one of the shaping functions of our life.
We must memorialize the culture before we go. Mm-hmm. We're not getting any younger. Mm-hmm. Seas aren't getting any lower.
We could still get COVID, both of us.
I was just telling you, my son, who I always knew would get COVID in the dorms and immediately bring it home, told us in the car on the way to the airport on Friday, hey, I have a sniffle and a sore throat.
Ugh.
5 minutes after we could have given him the Biden tests that litter our closet.
Yeah, but you're in the car, you're halfway to the airport.
Halfway to the airport, and it's not until in a different time zone the next morning that we go to a drugstore and get him a test. And he's
passed. After flying, and he's coughing all over an entire airplane.
He's like asymptomatic. But still,
except for the sore throat and the stuffy nose,
that's true. No, he does have mild cold symptoms that he had just come over him that afternoon, and he tested positive. And so we spent the next 5 days. Well, we stuck him in the basement and said, "You're not allowed to see your grandparents or indeed anyone."
Good.
And
although not really a punishment for a teen,
yeah,
is he still a teen? He's still a teen for a little
bit.
Right?
If you're in college and you're 19, are you a teen?
You're a teen.
I think you're a teen,
it's
which
right
is good.
In the name.
Because if I want to like kind of diss him, I can be like my doofusy teen. Later, you have to be like my yo-yo son, who is a college sophomore, and it's like eight more syllables.
Yeah, that's too much.
It really diffuses the diss.
You can just condense it down to yo-yo. I think that encompasses
my dingbat son, who is now in his mid 40s.
So he right now is still. You're back. You're here coughing on me, but he's sequestered in a basement somewhere.
We were testing negative every day, and now I think it's 5 days later, and he managed to not give it to anyone.
I believe it. Checks out.
Well, I mean, the second he said that, I was like, Dylan, put on a mask.
Right.
And he did. But, you know, I was eating airport food next to him thinking, this kid doesn't really have, surely he doesn't really have COVID.
It's one of the crazy things where it's somehow he can sit next to you on a plane and be in the car and be like, I think, and somehow you don't get it, but then you read other accounts and it's like, oh, I passed by someone in a hallway and we all got COVID.
I was halfway across a restaurant. Yeah, it's just basically it's reinforcing my idea that I'm some kind of a superior Ubermensch and I will never get COVID.
I thought you were going to say reinforcing your idea that it's all a
that it's all made up.
It's all made up, and that mask mandates were Biden's attempt to, I don't remember. I'm not up on all the conspiracies.
Something, something, George Soros,
yeah,
something,
something, right?
Right?
That's what it was. Yeah.
See how that makes sense.
Created
now?
In a lab, something, something, George Soros, something, something.
just that I'm never going to get it, never going to get it.
Never going to get it?
Never going to get it. Never going to get it. That's my COVID theme.
I am super worried about getting COVID still. 2.5, 3 years. I don't know. I don't know how long it's been. I don't know how long it's been. But my daughter's mother got it last week. And luck of the draw, we were all, she was in Oregon and she stayed in Oregon.
You didn't have to lock her in a basement watching Scorsese movies on an iPad, which is what my son did.
Nope. She was in a hotel and I said, just stay in the hotel and charge it to your, to your work, because they gave you COVID in the first place. And so, yeah, my daughter and I had a couple of weeks just bouncing around, going to, you know, I took her to every model train and World War II museum in the region.
Way to look on the sunny side of COVID.
But we didn't get, I didn't get it, but I'm flying to Pennsylvania next week. And
that's where you're going to get it.
I'm going to get it there.
I can't believe I brought COVID to Utah. Like I'm going to go to the Red State where everybody's, you know, licking each other in the mall. And instead of getting COVID there, I bring it in the persona of my teen.
Yeah, I'm going to South Central Pennsylvania, where
do the Amish have COVID?
They never wore a mask once, and I'm going to be the one that's like the vector.
You can't wear masks, English. They have elastic on the ears. Mm-hmm. I've never actually heard an Amish person talk.
No, it's right there in the Bible. Can't put elastic on the ears.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's exactly right. No elastic on any orifice. Is what
it's a mistranslation
said?
Because it went through Pennsylvania German. But you wrote me yesterday. You texted me and said,
I was going to say, I don't want the brain fog. That's the main reason I don't like COVID.
Can you imagine doing this show with more brain fog than we already have?
It would sound, first of all, this show would sound exactly the same. But Jeopardy would be a train wreck. Yeah, I texted you to say, hey, I just realized I've been in the San Juans all day, and then my wife got me Belle and Sebastian tickets for my birthday.
Aww.
I don't know when I'm going to...
You guys are the love story for the ages.
We really are.
Yeah.
In a way, she's Belle and I'm Sebastian.
I know, you're so cute.
I'm the boy Sebastian.
The fact that you both wear rabbit ears whenever we come over for dinner,
we're,
so
you know,
cute.
We are kind of having a fight, but it's over which matching Winnie the Pooh tattoo we're going to get.
Yeah.
Do you want Tigger or do you want Eeyore?
No. You want Pooh flying a kite, but the kite has a yin-yang symbol on it.
Oh, the Tao of Pooh.
Yeah.
I don't know. How twee is Asian mysticism? We should rank everything in terms of tweeness on
how
a scale of 1 to 10.
I
have tweeness envy.
Asian mysticism as translated through West Coast pseudo-Buddhism? Yeah.
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
Yeah.
But motorcycles aren't twee.
No, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance isn't twee, but carrying that book under your arm in high school is twee.
We need to decide how twee everything is, because... I said, I don't know when I'm going to actually prep Omnibus because I'm at a Belle and Sebastian show. And that's when I realized.
And I rolled my eyes so hard.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Sounded like a bowling rink.
You're keeping it so 2003. And then you said, say hi to Christopher Frizzell. So you know who your Belle and Sebastian friends are.
Oh, I could have named 40 people at that show. And I'm sorry that I wasn't. Sorry I could not travel both, but be one traveler long I stood.
Traveler. So you were not deprecating the scene. How can an early 2000s indie pop veteran like yourself have a bad word to say about Belle and Sebastian?
I do not. Belle and Sebastian were key players in the music scene that I ultimately inhabited. So I was,
because you came through a weird way. You came through your Ron Swanson Alaska cabin way,
yes.
But then you saw these sweet Scottish lads holding balloons, and you were like, "That's
la 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 la.
That's
la,
how
la.
I become a rock star, I guess." And you left your power tools,
yeah.
And you walked through the tundra until you got to Olympia, Washington.
Well, you know, my journey to being a rock musician took me over hill and dale. You know, but be one traveler, long I stood and looked down one as far as I could, Ken.
Ken, did I ever tell you about the time I walked across indie rock?
But, you know, I am only a year younger than Kurt Cobain. And
aging much better.
Thank you. And I'm the same age as the guys in Radiohead, except for the young one. And so I should have, if I'd done the normal rock thing of being in a band when I was 22, I should have.
Yeah, if you could have just done the normal rock thing of being in the biggest band in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Or one of the two or three biggest bands.
Think how many cars I would have, Ken.
But you know, normally what you do as a rock person is you are really into rock in your teens. You start a band with your friends. I'm just paraphrasing from every issue of Cream magazine. And then, you know, you play a bunch of shows when you're 20 and 21, you get signed and then
you're sleeping on somebody's couch
and you're playing and your first record is either the one or it's your second record's the one or whatever. But usually by the time you're 26, it's established. Did you make it or not? And most musicians, by the time they're 26, if they haven't had any traction, they start to wrap it up. You know.
But you're like the 26-year-old guy playing quarterback for BYU. But you're an older, cagier version of them. You can run circles around these kids.
Well, the problem was I didn't get sober until I was 26, and before I got sober, I couldn't keep two quarters in my pocket. You know, I didn't have a
guitar.
Much
less keep a guitar tuned.
I didn't have a place to live. So there was no way to be in a band. Because I wasn't one of those junkies that had like supportive friends.
It sounds like you're really blaming your friends for not making you Tom York.
So I didn't start. I didn't really start playing music until I was 26, 27.
And by that time, the wave to catch was?
Well, so grunge
sweet,
was...
Sweet, dainty, Glaswegian...
Grunge, not yet. Grunge was over, but there was not... It wasn't quite clear what was next. And for that period in the late 90s, it was like, is it math rock? Is it post-math? Is it post-pre-math?
You're a smart guy. You can probably keep 7-4 in your head. Yeah. You could have been a math rock god.
For sure. There's lots of alternative time signatures in the Long Winters. But you know, it was like, is it hardcore? Is it post-hardcore? Is every band going to sound like Botch? Like, who knows? And it was only, and then indie started to, and indie, what did indie mean? It was like, does it sound like Pavement? Is Pavement twee?
Indie comes from a release strategy. It's not a genre.
Yeah.
It's a label.
But for a long time in the middle there, it was like, oh, we're the next movement of music is to be really difficult to listen to. And it was only when twee started to fill in all the cracks.
What if music was pretty and it was about my high school girlfriend?
So my bands in the 90s, late 90s, were loud. We had big amplifiers. We played shows with other bands that had big amplifiers. We were using the amps that Aerosmith used because that was all anybody had ever thought of.
The same ones. You bought
the
them
very
off
ones.
eBay. They still had scarves on them.
They all have Aerosmith stenciled on the back. They were cheap at the time. And when that first generation of bands, and they were all a lot younger than me, I remember the first time I played with a band, they opened for us, and we had our amps, you know, big wall of amps. It was so loud, too loud to even be in the room. And all bands were like this. All distortion, shoegazy loud. And this band came in and put their amps down in front of our amps, and they were basically toys.
Their amp was a Toys R Us ukulele.
They were just toys. And they had
Fisher Prices.
That whole vibe of like they carried
first Marshall stack.
They carried their stuff in like a little makeup case from the 60s and then they put their little toy amp on top. And we were like, what is this? And it turned out they were great. The band was great. And so
it turned out doll furniture was the future.
It began a long and I have to say painful readjustment.
Decline into sensitivity. But really, you were probably at an age where that's what you want, because you were older than the rest of the bands that had to adjust. You were poised. You were poised to start wearing sweaters on stage.
Every one of the people that I came up with in the music scene had quit music right around the age of 30. It's understood, at least it was. You're 30, dude. Quit.
Go to work for your dad's company.
Yeah, go get a job. And I was 30, 31, and didn't quit. And all of a sudden I had to wheel my giant amp down to the guitar store.
Had to sell it back to Aerosmith.
And trade it in on a little thing the size of a boombox and like relearn. I had to relearn everything. Twee.
It seems like a story about actually you jettisoning the toxic masculinity of the big phallic amp and embracing a softer, gentler you.
Well, yeah, except the band that I was in with the big amps, the lead guitar player was a woman who was like the loudest one in the band. And I jettisoned all the toxic masculinity, and then my next band was just all dudes.
Have you seen Belle and Sebastian?
Yes.
Lately?
No. I saw them handful era? Of times in the 2000s.
The peak of their powers.
Yeah, we played on a bill together in Spain. Yeah, I mean, I was a member of that music scene. So, yeah, I saw them every chance I could.
It's funny to see them now because they are the most guaranteed crowd-pleasy show of that generation. Stuart Murdoch, the frontman, once kind of a shy wee lad grappling with chronic fatigue syndrome, is now basically a lounge singer.
Uh-huh.
He spars with his bandmates in witty repartee
in a delightful brogue.
And the accent carries it. Obviously, we can't emphasize enough in this twee entry how important the accents are.
Is he wearing an Arab strap?
Yeah, probably. I mean,
you couldn't see it.
Well, he didn't show it off, but almost certainly, right? Isn't that what keeps you whimsical at his age?
Well, that's a big question, right? What does keep you whimsical past, if not drugs or Jesus, like where does whimsy come from middle age?
Maybe it's from grappling with chronic fatigue syndrome. And now he's just grateful for every moment he can take requests from an adoring audience, and he dances and hops and prances. The funny thing about Belle and Sebastian is in their early days, those early EPs, I think their contract with Jeepster specified that they would never give an interview. They would never do a photo shoot. They would never promote their music in any way.
That was the style of the time.
So those early EPs are very mysterious. And if you got one, you were like, who are these clip art people on the cover? They kind of had the Smiths thing of having just mysterious black and white photos, and you'd pour through the weird little essays and the liner notes and the lyrics. Is this really about him and Isabel? Are these real people? Is there a Belle? Is there a Sebastian? And now they're a lounge act that charters Mediterranean cruises.
What was interesting at the time was like when Bronski Beat came out in the mid 80s, singing in a very falsetto voice, it was kind of the first, I think of Bronski Beat as the first truly kind of twee English pop band. They foreshadowed a lot of twee sounds.
Yes, you are getting the era right. But I think of this as a Belle and Sebastian late 90s thing, and it's not. I missed the first 10 years and had to go back.
But Bronski Beat, what set them apart, but aside from their incredibly like affecting and revolutionary sound when they first arrived, I mean, it was like getting hit with a wallop the first time you heard them, because it was so, it's this strange falsetto, but it's like so passionate. And a lot of that passion was that they were singing openly about gay rights and the experiences of gay men at a time when that was not yet a thing. They were kind of, in a way, like the first.
They walked so Pet Shop Boys could run.
Yeah. And I mean, and Pet Shop Boys even masked their, and George Michael, I mean, George Michael didn't come out until deep in his career, but they were like overtly, openly out. And so the sound and the politics were really, you know, they worked together, right? Like this music sounds incredibly fey, and it's also very political. And it reinforced the idea that if you were a male vocalist and you sang like this, that it was a political act. But Belle and Sebastian were ambiguous, but you know, they're resolutely straight.
That's what I was going to say. Extremely sensitive, but like nothing about the twee movement as it's come down to us in the early 21st century is queer at all.
No.
It is sensitive boys, but with their skinny white girlfriends talking about mooning about their walking home hand in hand from the library.
But what felt political about it was that we were coming out of, I mean, you know, grunge was very progressive politically.
Yeah.
But sonically, it was just dude bros.
Well, that's the thing about the emergence of twee in Britain in the 80s is it's coming, it's a post-punk movement. So it's, you know, it's, right. You know, in the same way that these Belle and Sebastian bands are reacting to very yelly masculine grunge, these are bands who have seen the punk movement take the world by storm, but it's aggressive, and it's got the very masculine posturing of cool. You know, it's not that different than kind of 50s greasers, you know, like in the way that, like, to be cool is to have a pose, and that pose is unemotional. I mean, you're yelling about, you know, you're mad at Margaret Thatcher or whoever. You have something to yell at, but it is a pose. You know, you care about the issues, but your manner is very much calculated to have a bravado and a swagger. And Twee, I think, could not be more of the opposite of that. They took, you know, these are bands that took that DEY impulse. Like, what if we started playing music that was very simple? But these were the kids that had no time for rejected the callousness of that kind of cool. And we're like, well, we could make a little stage in your mom's basement. And what if we cut little stars out of construction paper, and we'll just wear the stripy shirts that, you know, it's often described as an adult version of the first day of kindergarten outfit. Because these were not the cool kids. These were the geeks and the virgins, and they still wanted to put on a show.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, the new romantic movement, which reacted to punk in that way and went very glam, very, you know, it was coming from glam,
yes,
right? An extension of it. And in the early 80s, it registered as very, very gay because of the makeup and the hair and the costumes. But it was.
And it was hugely transforming for a generation of gay kids to be like, look, they're wearing makeup.
But most of those people were straight. Extremely straight, right? I mean, even Nick Rhodes of Duran Duran is like, just couldn't be straighter.
But we had to lie about it to seem more interesting.
But then, you know, it introduced Kaja Goo Goo. It introduced, what was the band? It was the first band that wore sweaters. What the hell were they called? I can't put my head, I probably have COVID. That's why I have this brain fog.
It's brain fog. Brain fog made you forget every band but Kaja Goo Goo.
But they were extremely clean cut. Please write in and tell me who I'm thinking of. They wore sweaters. They played their guitars very high up. It was a whole look. It wasn't Modern English. It was, anyway. I mean, you think about Boy George, right? Like, that's all very.
That's one reaction to punk.
That's very glam reaction to punk, and there is politics in it, but it's not this, like, we're too sensitive to live in the world vibe that comes with Twee. Boy George was like right in your face.
Yeah, these were quiet kids coming home from the library, and their musical antecedents were, you know, they couldn't be more different than Sex Pistols. It was bubblegum pop, 60s girl groups, all these, you know, jangly birds guitar. It was this kind of stuff. And so all over Britain, there are little pockets of kids in middle-class homes who are kind of playing with the punk, with the punk DIY thing, doing it themselves. So they don't have the musical virtuosity or the training. The singer will have kind of a wispy, dreamy voice, you know, because of authenticity. And, you know, you're not going to belt it out. Like, you know, you couldn't be more different than a Roger Daltrey or a Kanye kind of star.
Yeah.
But it's not just to convey that kind of sincerity. It's also because they didn't have trained voices and they were teaching themselves how to play guitar. And it kind of went with the 80s slacker aesthetic, you know. So here's some easy, lazy melodies. This was the first thing we thought of that we could play the chords of. John Peel called it shambling. That was kind of the British equivalent of what would become slacker pavement aesthetic, you know, bands that were just kind of doing the least effort to dress, to play, to songwrite.
And there, this was true all the way through the 2000s, the 2020s, the political idea that not being trained or ready, which was a very punk idea.
I don't want you to get started on your punk stuff.
No, don't get me started on the punk stuff. But that notion that being amateur was preferable is such a powerful idea in the arts. You know, it's not.
It gets you over that hump of how do I get from here to there?
It's not like, a powerful idea in like medicine or science or
maybe
like
today, increasingly today,
soldiering. But in terms of like making art, it's yeah, it's just it's so captivating, the idea, the notion. And I don't think, you know, I don't think in the 50s, if you went into a jazz context and said to a bunch of musicians like, no, I don't really know anything about music, I can't really read music or anything, I just kind of play what I feel, they would not be into this vibe. But somehow, somewhere along the line, I think post 70s, it's become kind of a dominant theme in the arts, or at least a constant theme.
And I think it's because that's what when young people read, let's take literature, you read like a Salinger or a Vonnegut or somebody that just seems like they've invented a voice that's just theirs and they're just talking to you in it and they're just putting it over through their honesty and individuality, you think, wait, how do I do this, you know? Well, I just do the same thing, I just say what comes to mind and I sound like me and I sing about the girl who moved and made me sad.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think the first bands I heard like this were, I mean, they often were, had prominent women in the band. You mentioned, that change, bands like the Field Mice, which were, you know, kind of wispy, sad little songs, Could Not Be Quieter, or Tallulah Gosh, the forerunner band of Amelia Fletcher's Heavenly, which was, you know, that was more of a kind of a sugary, fun, poppy kind of thing. But
that's the thing, the fun, like the intersection of fun and sad is a big part of, that's the corner where Twee lives, right? On the corner of fun and sad.
They used to live there, but then they moved away and now we're sad.
But we still dance on the fairy ring.
These songs often, were fascinated with nostalgia and childhood, and they're by young people, but they're by young people remembering that first love, that first kiss, playing soccer, you know, with your mates, walking home from whatever, sitting on the bus by somebody and thinking they're cute.
Soccer is so exhausting, though.
they probably weren't playing that hard. But, you know, just that the whole suspicion of adulthood and the escape back into childhood tropes. And with it, a focus on the things that matter to children or that our culture has told us matter to children. Some essential goodness and gentleness. There's a sweetness and a purity there that allows you to just, and if you haven't been good at being the cool kid, well, hey, you know, when I was happy and untroubled by this stuff, and I'm sympathetic to this. I remember, you know, very much being a Gen X kid who didn't feel like he could just go home and, you know, draw maps of fantasy kingdoms or whatever. I really brought me pure happiness as a child. But that just wasn't going to do anymore.
Because you had to work in the coal mines. You had to start breaking rock.
No, I just had to like know more about like the NBA and whatever my friends were interested in.
Now, what is that in the culture? Because we're living in the world of it now, where the child and childhood and innocence are things that I think almost at any time in human history, going back 400,000 years until,
yes,
very recently, childhood was a thing to grow out of and leave behind. And there was very little, even among the romantics, even among the people that were the most, in their lace handkerchiefs, there was no lionizing of childhood.
Goethe and Byron aren't saying, it would take a mystic like William Blake to actually think there was something virtuous about childhood. And that's why that work is held up so well. But it was just the occasional oddball.
Yeah. Otherwise, everything was directed at leaving childhood behind.
And it wasn't understood that childhood, I mean, not that there wasn't culturally anything special about it, which was also true. Get that kid to the coal mine. But it was very much like, there was no understanding that children thought and worked differently. People somehow didn't remember. Children were thought of as miniature adults, and the quicker they could learn table manners and a good work ethic, the better.
Yeah, I think it would have been described not that they think differently, but that they think poorly or exactly. incompletely, yeah. right? Yeah. Like, oh, whereas, that is how a child thinks.
Whereas today we think of the sense of wonder and awe, yeah. and how do I reconnect with that? No, yeah. no even recognition, much less valorization of that.
And I guess a lot of that started to happen in the literature around Winnie the Pooh and...
Bingo. Let's talk about Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, right.
I was looking back at a cultural study of the Twee movement by... an author whose name I can't remember. Mark Spitz. Journalist Mark Spitz.
Talking not the Olympic swimmer.
Yes, it was actually the Olympic swimmer.
Uh-huh. He writes, also a Twee
scholar. He writes with those 9 medals around his neck, and it makes a clanking noise as he leans over the keyboard.
Uh-huh.
And it gets in his... When he does interviews, it gets in the mic. So often he can't hear his subject speak.
Tinkle, tinkle.
In this book, he traces the Twee movement back to certainly childhood signifiers, but I think because he's American, he thinks... To understand Zooey Deschanel playing the ukulele, you got to understand. And for him, it's like...
Cannot understand it. You just have to...
you just have to roll
just
with it.
Just go with it.
Why is she wearing a dollar store tiara, John? Don't ask, why?
Don't ask.
To
she
him,
got it from Courtney Love.
To him, it's like, okay, you got to understand Judy Blume. You got to understand Walt Disney and Dr. Seuss. And I think this is an oddly American take on Twee. Like, I think to understand Twee, you have to understand both Britishness and the outsider's fetishization of Britishness.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's 100% Winnie the Pooh. These were books that kind of romanticized not just the Edwardian nursery and childhood dreaminess, making up little poems and hums. You know, childhood is not just all having adventures and shooting slingshots at your mates. It's also just lying under a tree and looking at a cloud and making up a song to the cloud.
Yeah, having a mild speech impediment and wanting to play with your little stuffed kangaroo.
That's just an upper-class British accent. They don't all have speech impediments. Some of those Woodhouse characters are trying to talk like that. And yeah, and the countryside, the beautiful British forest, you know, being with your girlfriend at the Grand Canyon is not Twee, but being in a birch forest with a carpet of bluebells underfoot. That's yeah. Twee.
The whole feeling that like the woods behind your house was infinitely large.
Yes.
And as you get older and you realize you go back home and you're like, everything's so small, but that feeling.
And Christopher Robin is walking through those woods with a teddy bear, and Stuart Murdoch is walking through those woods with a girl in a librarian skirt, but it's kind of the same woods, right?
Yeah.
And the thing about those Winnie the Pooh books is they sold just bajillions of copies, mostly to adults. You know, like I think adults were like, oh, my kid will love this because it's a view of childhood. It was the first time somebody had said kids make up little words and songs. And it's not kind of the sneering or not sneering, but the harder edged Lewis Carroll kind of nonsense.
Yeah, right. Alice in Wonderland has elements of it, but Alice in Wonderland is scary.
It's whimsical, but it's also scary. Yeah, it's dealing more with a lot of childhood id and then adult concerns of logic and riddles and wordplay that we've discussed that really appeal to only a small, odd number of kids.
Yeah.
And that's kind of an adult's idea of what kids will think is fun.
Yeah, it feels like someone ate some tainted grain.
where there's nothing psychedelic about poo. It's just
soft.
It's just friends singing exceedingly gentle songs of nonsense syllables.
Eeyore is so sad, but we still love him. He's kind of annoying, but we love him.
Dorothy Parker famously reviewed House at Pooh Corner for, where was she reviewing for? The New Yorker or The Atlantic?
Beautiful.
She did a series of, you know, she did a series of reviews, I think pseudonymously assigned to somebody to call Constant Reader. And in the third person, Constant Reader would tell you about the new Sinclair Lewis or
A.A. Milne.
In this case.
Sinclair Lewis or...
I was going to say Somerset Maugham or somebody. Evelyn Waugh. But in this case, she reviewed Winnie the Pooh. And after...
The times used to be better. I'm sorry.
Dorothy Parker reviews Winnie the Pooh.
Under the name Constance Reader for The New Yorker.
After you know, after quoting Pooh and Piglet's tiddly pom hum at length.
And nobody knows tiddly pom.
Oh, you know
how cold my toes.
You know the lyrics. And you've made up a
how
tune?
How cold my toes tiddly pom are growing tiddly pom. No,
did
Piglet.
Loggins and Messina cover this? How do you know this?
No, Piglet, you don't say tiddlypom at the end, only in between. How do I know? Because I played Christopher Robin at the Shoreline Community College production of House at Pooh Corner in 1978. A year ago. And I was the rest of them were all community college students.
How short were your shorts?
They were pretty short.
Could we see your Arab strap?
No. I have pictures of it somewhere. But yeah, they cast a real child as Christopher Robin.
And adults as all the animals?
And all the animals were college students.
And you were the lone child. I was the lone child. Tossed into the world of community theater. This explains a lot about you.
And it was a musical. I sang all the Christopher Robin parts. The first day of practice, I showed up and did my lines in rehearsals. I mean, did my lines in an English accent. And at the end, the director was like, let's kill the accent.
I think you might have told me that before.
Anyway.
Christopher Robin. So Dorothy Parker famously finished the review. At that point, Constant Weeder flowed up. And that kind of a baby talk thing, you know, replacing the K's with the T's and leaving off letters and replacing the R's with W is really what gives us the word twee. Its first printed appearance was in 1905 in a Punch serial called At a Moment's Notice, kind of a satirical look at the bright young things of the day with the smart set in London, maybe in their motor cars. 1905 might be too early. Exactly. The author is just the initialed M.A. I don't even know who it is, but she's quoting her cousin Phyllis, who's always inventing slang. She sees an organ grinder's monkey and says, "Isn't he divy?" which is a word she's invented for divine. "Oh, he's just too trotty for words. Look how ducky his little ears are." And at the end, she says, somebody objects to this characterization of the monkey, and she says, "Well, I call him perfectly twee." And it's assumed to be, and I believe this to be true, given the Tonstant Weeder float up, it's a baby talk corruption of sweet.
Oh, he's twee.
He twee, the same way that Tweety Pie, Tweety Pie is a pun on Sweetie Pie, and that's how the Friz Freleng Looney Tunes bird gets its name. I don't know if the word appears again until 1917. A British comic author named M.T., can't read my own writing, something like Hasseleen, who is also a vicar, because of course he is.
Of course, Vicar Hasseleen.
Writes a series of satirical, mildly comic novels, as everyone was doing in Britain back then. And he has a Navy paymaster called Tootleum Dibbs, because you could be in the Navy and be nicknamed Tootleums.
Yeah, absolutely.
Back then. Tootleum Dibbs is, because he's a paymaster, he doesn't really understand much of what happens on a naval ship. But he's showing around a group of young Girl Scouts that I think he's got a... Right. His eyes on.
This all checks out.
And
Tweedledum Pigs is showing Girl Scouts around a Navy ship.
Tweedledum Pigs shows one of the kids, shows one of the young girls, the doughy-eyed, rosy-cheeked young girls.
Doughy eye is a different condition.
Yeah. I don't know if you can have a doughy eye. Ugh. I have many doughy parts, but she sees some kind of weapon and says, "Oh, but it's so small." And he says, "Well, that must be a practice weapon. He's just making things up. He doesn't know."
Right.
And she's like, "Well, I think it's too twee for words." So it appears to have kind of become a British youth slang for sweet among a certain kind of
lollipop
simpering girl. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Dora from Charles Dickens.
But this is like an occasional citation of basically a speech impediment more than a slang term until 1967.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There's a big jump here. We're now in swinging Carnaby Street, London. Can you imagine it? Lynn Redgrave is starring in a movie I don't remember. I'm sure she's wearing go-go boots, called Smashing Time, about the scene in Chelsea or wherever. And unfortunately, this movie, which is half in swinging London slang, is written by a George Melly.
He's 75 years old.
He is in his 40s. And he has no idea what the young people are saying in London. So if you watch the movie, it's got all these teens saying things like, "He's having the spadiest freak out of all time."
Yeah, which totally spady.
I'm sure is made up and possibly a racial slur. I don't even know. It's kind of like, but you know, there's Stephen Sondheim has said that when he was writing West Side Story, he did not know what young people were saying. And he knew if he got it right, it would just be dated 6 months later. So he kind of invented what sounded like youth slang.
And then created youth slang.
And that's why the Jets and the Sharks are saying things like, you know,
You're the one that knows the script of West Side Story.
Suddenly I don't have an example. But anyway, all the things that the young kids say there are just, you know, a middle-aged gay man's idea of what sounds like youth slang but will fool a Broadway audience and won't date in a year. And when the movie is released in America, the studio, to instruct American audiences to what they're hearing, releases a glossary of London slang.
Kind of like the glossary that came with the movie Dune.
That's right. Yeah, you need to study up. In this case, it's more like the grunge lexicon.
Oh, sure. Swinging on the flippity flop.
Because it's largely made up. It's this made up guy. It's this 40-something guy's idea of swinging Austin Powers slang. And in that list, he tells American journalists and writers and readers that twee is London slang for camp. You know, it's...
Oh, so it's not... So he would have probably heard twee... In his day.
It's going back 50 years.
Yeah.
And he's kind of got it right. You know, by the time you put the baby talk on it, it conveys a certain kind of, you know, it means sweet. It conveys a certain kind of childlike gentleness, but it's been filtered through, you know, baby talk. So possibly a sneering outsider's view of it, which gets to our modern definition of twee, which again is all about gentle childhood and feelings and sensitivity. But when it's used, it's often used in an arch way, like to comment on those things. You know, it was music critics that first started using twee in the 90s, especially CMJ, started using twee to refer to this sensitive 80s post-punk music from Sarah Records and you know, all their little 7 inches. And the scene that had formed out of that, what happened was NME occasionally did a mixtape, yeah. You know, and it would just be like, here's some holiday music. Here's some soul, you know, here's some 1960s R&B. In this case, they put out a mixtape, a cassette, C86, which was all these little local basement bands.
Playing xylophones.
Playing ukuleles and xylophones. And suddenly this... disparate group of do-it-yourself post-punkers became a scene and found each other and started to get attention on labels. I think C86 came out in, it might be 86. That might be why it's so named. It might have been an annual NME thing. And so when music critics started saying twee, they were, it was a bit of a pejorative. It was like, oh, look at this dainty little music now. Isn't it just too precious for words?
It remained a pejorative right alongside it being a...
It kind of is both today.
Yeah.
This is one of the great enigmas of twee, is that it both refers to this kind of earnest, sincere art, but it also refers to extremely mannered retro artists like Wes Anderson. You know, like, I think he's described as twee very often, and...
It's a compliment, it's an insult, it's just a straight descriptor. It's all those things simultaneously.
And that's not unusual for a genre to be defined after the fact by a critical voice instead of the actual, in this case, the actual, you know, women pressing the 7 inches.
Although it became a methodology. Twee became there was a science to it, right? There were...
Once there's a scene and you see these bands getting signed... Okay, well, maybe I should wear ruffles and maybe
I should get a dime store tiara. And...
Yeah, maybe you should play the ukulele or the banjo instead of the guitar, and now we're Mumford & Sons.
Right. Although they are not twee.
I mean, there's something... So twee metastasizes is what happens here. I mean, we're only up to the mid-80s, and it's about to hit America through no less than Calvin Johnson. Without Olympia Washington and K Records,
got a cold chill.
This might all just have died in Oxford and Manchester basements.
You invoked Calvin Johnson, and now the room grows dark.
Is the vibe gone now?
Okay, go ahead.
What's your experience? Happening?
No, let's not talk about my experience. Let's just stay on target.
Would there be litigation?
Stay on target.
If you were to tell some of your stories,
no. It's just, you know, we're now traipsing into.
This is our scene.
We're backing into our scene.
This is here. Olympia, Washington.
Yeah.
And, you know, today K Records would be, we think of them as the label that broke Modest Mouse or, you know, put out Beck Records and then all the Riot Girl stuff. But in fact, Beat Happening was a reaction to punk. You know, Henry Rollins will snarl at you, but we're going to throw candy.
Yeah.
and they loved those that British music, and so they brought it over here. They released Heavenly, Amelia Fletcher's new band, and you know, Calvin Johnson duetted with her, and they appeared on each other's records, and they found other British bands like that to bring to the States, and then local, you know, now homegrown bands like that started popping up, just like when the British invasion hit. And suddenly,
except the local homegrown bands weren't exactly the Beach Boys,
right? Well, I mean, kind of like Kurt Cobain loved the Vaselines,
yeah.
You know, and the you know, the harder edged music that had come out of that pop scene. Jesus, you know, you don't get Jesus and Mary Chain and the Vaselines, and maybe therefore you don't get grunge, weirdly, or at least the grandma sweater Kurt Cobain variant of it,
right?
Without some of these British bands that he loved. And it becomes a culture. It's no longer just a rock critic thing to say. Twee starts to become an aesthetic, and it brings together disparate strands. You've got indie directors like Whit Stillman or Miranda July, and then later Wes Anderson, and then later Mumblecore, who are kind of doing a simpler, looking backwards kinds of things about goofy young people who don't mind if they don't look cool, because these are uncool directors. In literature, you've got Dave Eggers and all those McSweeney guys, the New Sincerity, then Karen Russell, Jonathan Safran Foer. You know, there's authors who get lumped in. Ira Glass invents This American Life, which then begets all of podcasting, which is, and there's something a little bit twee about, I just want to listen to my friends kind of have a, like, what's more shambling, in John Peel's word, than a podcast conversation?
Well, yeah.
Low effort. But it's kind of fun, and you feel like you get a good feeling from the good vibe.
And Ira's very just personally twee, like he embodies it.
Okay, and then it becomes a fashion thing. He's wearing right. The horn-rimmed glasses, and suddenly this kind of thing in the Obama era is everywhere, and it just becomes what we now think of as hipster Portlandia culture. You know, without twee, you don't get the mustaches and the farmers markets and the crocheted owls on Etsy and everybody trying artisanal pickles or chocolates or marmalades, and it just became a whole culture. And then that sweetness and the kittens and all, it becomes Zooey Deschanel singing "What Are You Doing on New Year" to Jonathan Gordon-Levitt on YouTube and getting 100 million views because she's got those big blank eyes and rosy cheeks. And
Siri, is it raining outside? Go look out the window.
Bangs.
What was interesting at the time was, you know, in the 80s, there was still a lot of suspicion, I think, in mainstream culture about Japan. Japan was still the other throughout the 80s.
It was weird. Like, we didn't think Hello Kitty was cute. We were like, what is this?
What is wrong with this?
Like Mickey Mouse is cute, but what the heck?
Yeah, they're coming to steal our jobs, and they're, you know. But then in the early 90s, the floodgates opened for that. Kind of, it wasn't even like appropriative. We just, in the music scene especially, just were newly fascinated with the style. And, you know, it might have been a generation that came up that now was exposed enough to Japanese cartoons and stuff that they wanted more.
If that's your baseline idea of cute, and it's not whatever Walt Disney invented in 1938, then you're more open to it.
But like the first time I saw Shonen Knife, it felt very revolutionary, but also like, what am I watching here? Like, this is loud.
I remember thinking that it was kind of unwholesome. Like when I saw early anime, I was like,
it's dirty.
This is not the kind of, I wasn't watching a dirty anime. I was watching some normal space one, and I was still like, no, this is not the vibe that I get from children's entertainment.
But But that was a big wave of like the accoutrement of childlike, you know, like there was all of a sudden a lot more baby talk and baby stuff and kittens and cutie cutes.
Belle and Sebastian took their name from a children's anime.
Uh-huh.
A French children's book about a kind of a boy in the Alps with his big white dog.
What's funny is that the Riot Girl thing really reappropriated the baby doll dress and the, you know, the like sexy baby thing.
Kitten ears.
Yeah, but done in an intentionally dirty, ripped fishnet way.
That's not twee.
No, but it allowed for it allowed that baby was punk. And then you could, then the next iteration was to just wear the straight up clean baby costume. It was no longer made punk, but it was somehow like it was in.
If you were uncomfortable with that, if you actually wore something a little more prep, well then fine. You can just wear your ballet flats and your cardigan on stage. And that's what everybody did for about, suddenly this was the biggest youth scene since punk and then hip hop.
And this would have been right in your mid 20s, right? You were the target audience for Quiet as the New Loud.
I feel like what it turned into, the whole Williamsburg mustache scene, that predates me a little. I feel like this is an omnibus for the millennials. Finally, we're going to throw them a bone.
Oh boy.
And we're not going to tell them about the emergency broadcasting system and the electric company. and instead we get to explain bangs and glasses and Portlandia to them. But see, so to me, it feels like I just missed it. Like if I had been cooler, if I'd actually been, you know, listening to the flexi disc in the middle of Q magazine every month in the early 90s, then maybe I would have caught some of this sooner.
But Quiet as the New Loud is very much a 2000 to 2008
phenomenon. I was married in the year 2000. Oh, is what you have to remember about my mid to late 20s.
It's so funny.
You were doing drugs.
I was still sleeping in a van that whole time, and you were already like, all right, kids, time to go to school.
Luckily, I didn't have kids until 2002. Yeah, there's your Quiet as the New Loud.
But yeah, boy, I'll say. But it introduced also all that Scandahoovian quiet vibe stuff, right? All the Norwegian, Danish,
Sigur Rós kind of.
Yeah, thing? but like, I don't, the pop stuff that came out of, I don't know, the anti-ABBA of Scandinavia during that time was all about.
Yeah, it diverged. You got Ace of Base on one hand, but then you got the exactly.
Yeah, I mean I'm talking about Scandinavian musicians that were not burning down churches.
Right.
But yeah, there's an awful lot of,
and Bjork can do both, which is amazing.
There you go. There are an awful lot of cardigan sweaters coming out of there.
And I don't know if the culture has settled on its judgment on Twee. I mean, was it, on the one hand, it was all about, you know, gentleness and goodness, and what if art was this? You know, Dave Eggers is just, you know, telling you like you don't have to be mean. What if we were all just kind and loved our little brother? Or very quickly turn, once it became a culture, then we're suspicious of it. Is this just saccharine?
How can you be
wankery?
Suspicious of it? It completely abolished meanness in our culture.
I mean, that's the thing. It didn't work. we now know. But I mean, but those individual artists like may have been like, I don't believe that, you know, when I see these people live or I read one of their books or I see a Miranda July movie, I don't think, look at this sociopath who got away with it. I think, look at these nice young people who were able to do art about it.
It's interesting because a lot of those artists, Miranda July and Dave Eggers, like they were making, I mean, they are earnest and accomplished, very real creators, right? Mm-hmm. But there was, like any scene,
there's 100 more.
Well, and there becomes a formula. And there was a formula for grunge, and there was a formula for psychedelic rock, and there's a formula for funk, and there became a formula for twee that you could just plug in.
Yeah.
And so there were
And then it seems saccharine because it probably is.
Well, and then what you get is fans that are responding to the formula of twee who have you didn't see this, I don't think, the same. I saw it for sure in grunge. People that came to grunge after it was a formula, and they had a formulaic fan response. They knew what they were supposed to look like,
yeah,
and how they were supposed to act and how they were supposed to feel. And being in the music scene and watching fans start to show up who had gone and thrown away all the old band stuff and had bought all the new band stuff. And they were like, is this twee? Am I twee? I am twee. Like, this is twee. And then the next kid would come in and they're like, that's not twee. This is twee. It affected me because it was my scene at the time. Yeah. And it wasn't my scene. I was 10 years older than everybody that was in it. But my band was not even twee, but definitely performing within that universe.
It was sensitive.
Yeah, and, you know, like...
Not as sensitive as Colin Malloy, but it was sensitive.
Oh, there's no sensitivity to Colin Malloy. No, it was, you know, like, we were playing with American Analog Set, and, you know, it was... And Death Cab, and it was a time when Well, it was the very beginning of a kind of trigger alert mentality of saying to your audience, like...
You don't want anything unpleasant.
Yeah, no, okay, everybody, you know... Like the first time I saw Elliott Smith and the audience all sat down on the floor at the Crocodile. And I was like, do you know how much barf there is on that floor? Get up.
I did kind of notice that Stuart Murdoch last night, he sounds like a children's television show host now. Something about the way he talks. Like he might as well be narrating Teletubbies.
And so I guess that, yeah, that was to watch it all go down. You know, there was a lot of Generation X suspicion about twee, even though most of the purveyors of it were Generation X entertainers at first, right? But it
Eggers and July and Calvin Johnson are
But it introduced what am I trying to say? Musicians have always been sensitive, but it introduced a new sensitivity. Like a
more performative sensitivity,
you always want your musicians to be vulnerable, but the vulnerability became it became fragile. Hmm. There was in order to pursue twee to its logical extent, you have to
the end of twee.
You have to become fragile, and when you think about Morrissey. Is very sensitive, but you don't get the feeling he's fragile
or healthy in any way
or nice even, you know?
Yeah.
But like, think about what's the first musician. I mean, all the junky jazz guys that all, you know, died or whatever. There were, like Nick Drake. Is he the first twee indie artist?
I mean, that's a great point. You know,
like too sensitive to live,
you know, Spitz's book just tends to go back to, people like Jonathan Richman, you know, emphasizing the outsider art part and not what I think of as the hallmark of twee, which is kind of the Nick Drake. I'm wispy, I'm British, and the world is too much with me. You know, like atmospheric pressure is going to just collapse my pale skin and capillary lungs at some point.
Because Jonathan Richman does the whole like I'm just a child, you know. Like,
yeah.
But he's also not fragile.
No, that's exactly. I think the let me suggest an source for twee that I haven't heard before. Tell me if you think this is crazy. Paul McCartney. Sometimes people point back to like yes. I don't think you get, people point back to, you know, the Zombies playing harpsichords or the Kinks and their Village Green Preservation Society.
But it's Paul McCartney sitting on his grandmother's lap playing vaudeville on a banjo.
Paul came from I was watching the Rick Rubin. Have you seen the Hulu series where Rick Rubin interviews him? He talks a lot about how he had a happy home where everybody sat and sang jolly songs around the piano. And he didn't realize. And that's how you get the Admiral Halsey voice, you know? Like all the, if you watch Get Back, you know all the Beatles love to do kooky voices for hours, and you have to fast forward. But think about the difference between John's kind of sneering, and now we'd like to do Ark the Angels Come, and Paul, who is very much like Admiral Halsey, you got to help me. He notified me that we're going to have tea, butter pie.
That's why John hated Paul.
I mean, it's got to be hard to put up with that.
Yes,
but imagine Paul in those pictures of him in 1970 with Linda on the farm, and he's wearing some an old sweater, kind of askew.
Yeah, when they moved up north.
Yeah, and he's singing, and he, you know, even when he's in the Beatles, he's the one putting children's lullabies, Edwardian, you know, Victorian lullabies in songs, and I mean, children's songs about submarines.
But what John failed to appreciate was that, from the listener's standpoint, we all read that as very sinister and weird. Right, John knew that Paul was earnestly a goofball, and so when Paul was like "I love it at all," John was like, "God, you suck!" But if
you filter it through me, it seems like psychedelia. We're all wearing epaulettes now.
Exactly. As listeners, I was like, "That voice is the weirdest of all." Like Paul being like a giant puppet, And John could never understand that what they were making was bigger than his personal problem with Paul's grandmother.
John had an unhappy childhood, and Paul didn't understand till he met those guys that.
But that's
that
the classic.
Were coming from a different place.
That's like, the old school dynamic. John was angry, but way more fragile.
Yeah.
Paul was punk. Sweet and doofy, but
totally healthy and self-actualized.
Completely
and,
not fragile at all.
You know, he meets, you know, Linda's got an adult kid and he's like, great, fab, let's adopt her. You know, like,
I know.
And then I can read Winnie the Pooh to her.
You can walk right up to Paul, get right in his face and go like, you suck, Paul. And he'd be like, whoa, fuck you. You know, like.
You think he'll do the Admiral Halsey voice?
I'm sure he would. Oh, peace and love.
He's singing songs about, even in the Beatles, he's the one doing songs about raccoons and sheepdogs and, you know, children's stuff, childhood.
I feel like the.
When he was happiest.
I feel like Nick Drake is maybe.
Nick Drake's good. Yeah, that's a good.
One of the first where, but he's not being a child, but he's very soft. And
he's a Byronic young man, but he's not out making conquests. He's thinking about I wish that I could.
And I guess there was no time period in history where it was safe to be that vulnerable, where you weren't as vulnerable as Twee is,
yeah.
Where you wouldn't be putting yourself in harm's way by exposing that much. But then it becomes performative and there are people that are fine.
And think about, you know, in every generation, but this one, think about the homophobia that would have accompanied being such a sensitive man. Like, I think in as recently as last year, I think Mindy thought Stuart Murdoch was gay. And I was like, no, the whole thing of the band is him writing 4 albums worth of songs during a ill-fated 6-week romance.
It's so funny because I always thought they were Christian.
No, you're thinking of Sixpence None the Richer.
I love Sixpence None the
that's
Richer.
That's the Christian Bella Sebastian.
She was so pretty.
We are kind of in a, let me just finish this by pointing out that we are possibly in a Twee return.
What? It never went away. How can we be returning?
The vibe shift people are all telling us, I think Twee kind of did go away once it reached its apotheosis of all the pastels and the Peter Pan collars and Zooey Deschanel on the ukulele. People realize this is not sustainable.
Time has compressed, and I still think we're there, but you're
I
right.
I know. It's a full decade.
12 years ago.
It's a full decade. And now the people who monitor such things, you know, like the guy in A Hard Day's Night that is worried that George Harrison knows about the new trend early.
Yeah.
All these people are saying, no, the pandemic has brought back Twee in the form of, you know, retro childhood stuff, you know, vinyl coming back and people wanting vintage, you know, old video games and to play the video games of their childhood.
Wait, vinyl's back again? How many times can vinyl come back?
But it's deeper than that. It's also just this general, and, you know, and TikTok personality, TikTok is no longer kind of cool mean girls. Like, TikTok is now full of the biggest names on TikTok. Many of them are, you know, it'll just be a guy who dresses in vintage train conductor uniforms and waves at engineers, you know? More Mr. Rogers than... if I could think of something edgy that started with Mr. here, I would say it. That would be perfect.
More Mr. Bungle.
More Mr. Rogers than Mr. It's got to be something better than that. and then all the, you know, the wholesome mass culture stuff, Schitt's Creek and Ted Lasso, where it's not wholesome, you know, people say, oh, this is the new wholesome art. And it's not wholesome in the sense of, you know, we would associate wholesome with, 1970s Disney movies. It's not that, you know, Ted Lasso has more F words than a Tarantino movie. And it's full of women of a certain age talking in graphic detail about how their sexual conquests went. But there's this overarching sweetness and unfailing optimism.
Yeah.
That goes to great effort. And it appears less false because it's got all the necessary trappings of modern culture. It's, you know, these are people who swear and who boink, but still, you know, they remember, they're suspicious of the cynicism of adulthood.
And it was funny. I remember what a second season of Ted Lasso, when they, within the script, it started introducing the fact that Ted was hiding a deep, dark secret.
That he has trauma.
And that his his earnestness and optimism was a coping mechanism. And I remember being disappointed that they did that.
You have to explain it.
The power of Ted Lasso.
There's just some guy who's like that and can change your life.
Yeah. And look at him, look at the power he has in the world.
Yeah.
And when it felt like they, as writers, needed to be ironic or needed to find a way that Ted was broken in order to contextualize this sweet power, it felt like a failure.
But what if the virtue of it is it shows that he chose it?
Well, but
we can all,
but the way the script seems to portray it is that it's a pathology.
It's a escape, right?
Yeah. Right. It feels like he's hyper coping.
I mean, that's an interesting thing about the return of Twee and all this kind of wholesome media in the time of the pandemic. I was somebody on Jeopardy the other day composed a limerick about me, and that was their contestant stories. They had written a limerick about me.
Humble brag.
And I was super. Yeah, exactly. Millions of people
when
in America.
When I was hosting Jeopardy the other day, a fan composed a limerick.
He was contestant on the show, but the people.
You remember it?
No, I had forgotten that it had happened because the shows air months earlier, and so many people are writing poetry about me. Jen.
Yeah, sure.
This airs, and suddenly everyone is sending this to me, like with a still of me just being delighted that a grown man has written a limerick about me, or a woman. Now I can't remember who the contestant was.
Well done.
It doesn't even who
you know
even
what
knows?
You don't even see gender.
It doesn't even matter to me, you know. And it could have been non-binary. It doesn't matter. Not to me.
Not to you.
And and people kept sending me this clip of my delighted face. And they're like, look how wholesome this is. You know, somehow I had become part of Ted Lasso media by virtue of being happy that a man had written a limerick about me.
I watched the last episode of 30 Rock the other night. Now I've watched 30 Rock all the way through two times.
You texted me. You were very sad that there were no more mountains to climb.
And I want to go back and just start again. I think for the rest of my life, I'm just going to always be somewhere in the middle of the six seasons of 30 Rock.
That's why people re-listen to podcasts.
But in the final episode of 30 Rock, you are name-checked because Tracy Jordan,
he's always getting Kenneth's name wrong.
He always screws up Kenneth's name. And at one point he goes, listen to me, Ken Jennings. And I missed it. But I was watching TV with a friend and she was like, he just called him Ken Jennings. I was like, no, you just hear Ken Jennings in the walls. But we went back and there it was. You're in the canon.
Kenneth Parcells is kind of wholesome media, but then we find out that his innocence is also kind of a pathology. Does that bother you?
No, his innocence is because he was born in the 15th century.
Yeah, he's centuries old. Here's what I think about Twee coming back in the TikTok era is it may be unwarranted optimism. Is it like, it's what you're saying. Is it just a unhealthy escape mechanism to fall back on wholesome feel-good media and rewatch The West Wing in 2022 because we know things are so bad? Think about how the previous kind of cool, the posturing 50s kind of cool, came out of a time when everything was good and everybody was making more money. You know, our parents were making more money than their parents had and the future for America looked bright and all these teens were like, whatever, I'm pissed off. And now it's the opposite. Things are bad, and the teens are like, no way. Think, what would Ted Lasso say? He'd say believe.
No, I honestly think and please, if you're gonna write me about this, please write to Ken at theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
Care of 30 Rock.
But I feel like the Twitter conviction that everything is as bad as it's ever been and that we are at the absolute, you know, the nadir of human history is in fact wrong.
That's the problem.
And that is the bad effect. That's the knock-on effect of some earlier Twee where our sensitivities have created. And I mean, believe me, when you write Ken, your angry retort and list all the things that are wrong in the world, I know them all.
Hey, John, what about climate change?
So what about the wars in Latin America, Ken? I know climate change, yes. But in fact, I think optimism is always the smart play. And I don't think it's a pose.
Even in the Pascal's wager way, it's rational to be optimistic. If the world's going to end, it doesn't matter if you were optimistic a couple of years earlier.
And if you want to put real optimism under a cardigan sweater, or you want to put real optimism
to
under
ukulele music?
Yeah, or you want to just look at science. If you want to do a Neil deGrasse Tyson version of optimism, you can
average GDP is up, hunger's down.
Yeah. Put your optimism in whatever color or sweater you want, but I think optimism is always the smart play.
If you take all these people who think it's the worst time in world history, just, you know, look at how many of them have smallpox. Zero. Game, set, and match.
And that concludes Twee! Entry 1352.1TH0207. Certificate number 16065 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era.
We're doing kind of a pessimistic podcast, I just realized.
We are? Well, oh, yeah. Right, because we're always like, nothing's going to survive.
The civilization's doomed.
But you know what? Time is a flat circle. To everything, there is a purpose under heaven.
We don't know when that's going to be.
No.
Put on your ballet flats and cut your bangs real weird.
And the thing is, we're talking to, you know, sentient mats of seaweed that probably are wearing their bangs weird and playing ukuleles.
Do you believe that Twee exists in all cultures and times?
Now that it has happened, you can never put Twee back in the bottle, right? In the same way that you can never put punk back in the bottle, you can never put jazz back in the bottle. Twee is part of
it's out there.
Part of the admixture of culture. Yeah. And there's always going to be someone
it's like COVID. Oh, there's reservoirs for it in deer and bats.
It has tremendous power. And I think of it as part of the family of topping from the bottom, which is a huge part of modern culture.
Really?
Yeah, topping from the bottom, which is
we had very different early 20s. What is? Tell me what topping from the bottom
within
is.
Within S&M, you know, you've got your top and your bottom.
I'm aware.
But you can have bottoms that are really running the show.
Oh, I see.
And tops that are performing the business of being one in power, but in fact it's the bottom that's making all the choices.
And what is the sociological simile here?
Well, so we've introduced like extreme like vulnerability into the culture, but there are a lot of people that weaponize it. And you can be you can use tremendous sensitivity and vulnerability and fragility as a way to be controlling. Not just of your personal situation, but controlling of organizations.
I've noticed that social media is full of sweet, tender souls who just turn out to be manipulative psychopaths.
Yeah, it's just another tool.
It's a bummer because then you can't believe the guy that's waving at the train engineers.
Yeah.
What if he was just getting fewer clicks when he was actually cool?
This is the problem with all things that there's no, you know, as soon as you say, well, this person's actually using their vulnerability to manipulate people, there's, you know.
You know, what we need is a swab test for Twee.
Well, our swab test for authenticity.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. It would be the same thing.
But that's what punk was trying to do all those years, Ken. You can't swab test for authenticity because there's always somebody that's like, I was punk before you. In the unlikely event in the future that there's any way to tell whether people are honest or not,
maybe there's some. Maybe they are. Maybe species will eventually evolve a way where you like turn your jellyfish shell turns blue if you are if you have cut your hair ironically or have
like a literal litmus test
or have said something sweet about your childhood that didn't actually happen.
You just carry around a little swab that turns orange,
and you're like, okay, it's like you hook somebody up to a polygraph, and you're like, tell me how sad you were when your girlfriend moved to a different school and you just had to walk by her house every night.
I'm so sad.
Boop. Oh, no.
No, I was. I was so sad.
You haven't thought about her.
No, I totally did.
You haven't thought about her in 20 years.
All those songs about her.
That even never happened.
If you want to know how sociopathic Ken is,
what do you do?
You can go on Twitter and see him making jokes that are too soon at Ken Jennings.
I made a joke about E.T. yesterday, and I got told not to make jokes about suspension of disbelief in movies because you're a big Scrooge and a Neil deGrasse Tyson if you do that.
Oh, because there's always somebody that's going to be like, well, how come?
Here's a plot hole for you.
Yeah,
and I get it.
End of this Star Wars, you couldn't even have a space station.
But our culture is now so gentle, you can't even.
Can't criticize E.T.
You can't even point out that you really can't have ferns and redwoods at the top of a Southern California mountain, which is my beef with E.T.
Oh, well, I always assumed that
he's on a dry brown hillside overlooking the valley.
Yeah.
But he and his friends bike up to the top of the hill, and suddenly there's ferns and redwoods. And also there's corn growing in their backyard. The biomes of E.T. I think you could write a book on.
But wait a minute. I always assumed that it was part of that weird that they were in outside of San Bernardino. You know, if you're in San Bernardino, it's like a sun-baked wasteland, but then you go up to Lake Arrowhead and it's like an elf kingdom.
I'm starting to wonder, as I say this, I wonder if E.T. is supposed to be set in Northern California, and they just shot it in Burbank. And so we all just assumed that view over the view out over the trees is the valley. And it's really supposed to be Muir Woods looking down onto Modesto or something.
Yeah, yeah, right. Or you could be in Grass Valley, California, except if you're just 7 miles this way, you got ferns up here in Donner Pass. And down river, you're in Sacto, where it's 140 degrees.
I don't think there's anywhere you can actually go from those dry, golden California hillsides up to ferns and redwoods on a bike.
Maybe not on a bike. Yeah. On a bike.
But yeah. E.T.'s a botanist. If there it was a place like that, he would go there, and he'd be like, hey, why do they have redwoods and and scrub oak and corn?
E.T.'s a botanist.
All growing on this same block. You didn't know that E.T. was a botanist?
No, I could. You can. He's out there getting.
He's gathering.
That's why they leave him behind, because he's like. Meh.
He's always making a geranium grow and wilt. He's really into that for some reason. What a weirdo! Just leave the geranium alone, E.T.
Ouch.
That's good.
Thank you.
40 years old this summer, by the way.
Ouch. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can hang out with other futurelings. Please, CC. Or, I'm sorry, copy and paste the letter you write to Ken about how things have never been worse, and then post it on our fan group on Facebook, The Futurelings, and see how long the moderators leave it up. No, there are no moderators anymore. It's free. It's a free zone.
Sometimes I delete stuff if it's duplicate. If it's duplicate?
If it duplicates if the letter they sent you already?
Or mean. No, but if two people post the same link, hey, this is remind me of the show.
Dear Ken, please tell John that things have never been worse. Signed, your formerly biggest fan.
I said Modesto, and I didn't really mean Modesto. I don't know what I'm thinking of. Something more Vacaville-ish. Or Santa Rosa, maybe?
You've got pavement on the brain.
We all have pavement on the brain.
If you want to send us some stuff, please do. Please send us your E.T. fan fic printed out.
Remember, he's a botanist.
To P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. And finally, and most importantly, if you enjoy the show and want to help us continue to make it, want to help.
This is the punk DIY twee aesthetic. John and I making these little 7-inch singles.
This is it.
And putting them in the ground.
This is the indie rock. This is the This American Life of Omnibus. Please support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Go to Patreon, join our community, and reap a windfall of extra content and feeling of having done the right thing.
It'll change your life. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our twee little civilization survived.
Bling, bling, bling.
We hope and pray. Yeah, we'll put some ukulele music under this. I'm sure Mark Miles can hook us up. We hope and pray. Oh, we can't because we're already doing the other sound bed. Can you do both? We hope and pray the catastrophe for may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.